Supposed to live on because.
Good afternoon, everyone. Today is March 7th, and this is the Subcommittee on Transportation and Economic Development. I am going to go ahead and reconvene our public hearing on House Bill 5025, the Oregon Business Development Department. And I'm going to invite Mr. Harder and his team to come forward as I call on Mr. Bender to just give us a quick update on where we're at, where we're going.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. Just to help orient and help you find some materials posted in OLIS, the agency is continuing with their presentation. That is posted with yesterday's OLIS, on OLIS with yesterday's subcommittee meeting, and they are displaying page 32 of that presentation. So if you go to page 32, you'll find that presentation. I'd also like to note there's an additional item that the agency has provided you, and we have that other. The second item is shown in today's subcommittee meeting date. You had requested a copy of the recommendations from the governor's small business cabinet, and there is an item there that has those recommendations in it. So if you have any, if anyone has any trouble finding either of those two documents, please let me know and I can help assist you.
Thank you, Mr. Bender, and I would certainly recommend committee members take a glance at the governor's small business cabinet. I was privileged to participate in that group meeting over the course of a number of months with a lot of citizen volunteers, and there was some good information exchanged there. So, Mr. Harder, welcome back.
Thank you. Thank you, Co-Chair Gomberg, Co-Chair Johnson, committee members. Just to kind of reground you and where we are, we provided the agency overview yesterday.
I'm just going to interrupt you, and for the record, you are still Mr. Harder, is that?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. That's fine.
Okay.
And we made it about halfway through our budget presentation, where we're focused on our budget drivers, both additions and reductions. Again, we are fully supportive of the governor's recommended budget on both of those, the budget additions and reductions. You also asked a couple questions related to criteria and eligibility for some of our infrastructure programs, industrial land, and then indebtedness with some of our finance programs. We think we're going to answer all those questions today and tomorrow when we get into the programmatic side. But if there's still further questions, we will make sure to follow up. So with that, I'd like to turn it over to our Assistant Director for Operations and Finance, Ramona Rademacher.
Good afternoon, Co-Chairs Gomberg, Johnson, and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Ramona Rademacher. I'm the Assistant Director for Operations and Finance for Business Oregon. Where we left off yesterday, as I was just beginning to talk about another one of the additions to our budget, and this one is $11 million in new lottery bond funding for the Governor's Regional Solutions projects. The operations budget for Regional Solution is actually in the Governor's office budget, but the project, the bonding, is in Business Oregon's budget. These grants are used to leverage public-private partnerships for high-profile economic development projects. Two examples of current projects that just show the range of the types of things that this team and the project funding is used for are one example that's ongoing right now is at the Baum Industrial Park, which is making structural improvements in Union County, and then goes from those more traditional type of investments also to things like the Wasco County Broadband Fiber Project to basically provide infrastructure in for the more modern age as well. The budget change from 1517 to 1719 is that in our current budget, we had a total of $13 million in project funding. $11 million of that was dedicated to the Regional Solutions Team project funding, and $2 million of it was dedicated to the Regional Accelerator and Innovation Network projects, which started out as one of their projects. This budget changes. It's $11 million for the Regional Solutions projects, and it ramps down to about $500,000 for RAIN, or the Regional Accelerator Information Network project.
Madam Co-Chair.
One thing that might be useful to our new members is to understand why this bifurcation happened, that some of this exists in the governor's office and some of it exists with you. I was one of the people that agitated for that aggressively, because we would get projects coming up from Regional Solutions that were aspirational in nature, but nobody, and I say this with respect, but no beady-eyed banker had taken a look at them to make sure that they worked. And OBDD is possessed of financial experts who can look at a balance sheet and see whether or not something foots. And the concern had been right straight along that Regional Solutions and their local enthusiasm for a project would get into it with inadequate resources to finish the work, and somehow then it would devolve to a state responsibility to patch the leaks in the boat. And common sense suggested that having the project scrutinized for their fiscal integrity by a shop that knew how to do that made a great deal of sense. And so that's how come this happened. I started out as a very strong advocate of Regional Solutions, but I think over time a number of things have happened to the program, including increasing bureaucratization. Regional Solutions was designed to fight that, and it's turning into the bureaucracy that it was designed to counteract. And the infusion of money with kind of inadequate explanation to the 11 Regional Solutions about how that money moves around. And we got into some difficulty already this session where some of the Regional Solutions districts thought that they had more flexibility than they did, and it resulted in a project, two projects, not going forward through LFO, and consequently, when the next tranche of bonds were sold, those projects weren't included. So there's now a new manager in the governor's office, and I think it will be helpful to have him have a conversation with Director Harder to understand what are the rules of engagement and how do we maximize the opportunities here. But that's the bifurcation, was to make sure that fiscal experts scrubbed these projects to make sure that they were feasible, completable, and they weren't just driven by enthusiasm. One question I might ask the professional staff is, within Regional Solutions, how is the governor's new regional solution manager / economic development manager paid? Where is that money coming from? And if you could just find out and report back to the committee, that'd be great.
Thank you, Chair. And before we leave Regional Solutions, back on page 13, we have a map of the various regions around the state. We don't need to pull that up, but I just wanted to reference that for the committee members. Could you give all of us a quick overview on how these different projects evolve? How is a project initiated? How is it recommended? How is it approved as we go through this process?
Co-Chair Gomberg, Co-Chair Johnson, committee members, I'll take the first stab at that. So the map that you actually see previous in the presentation, our regions now, when we did our realignment, match Regional Solutions. That was an attempt for us to sync up better. We have a very positive and collaborative relationship with them, so it made sense for us to do that. Each Regional Solutions team has a local or regional cabinet with representatives from staff from relevant agencies, and then I believe some outside citizen participation as well. Those projects are determined kind of through a solicitation and process there, and then we jointly review between Regional Solutions and Business Oregon.
Questions from the committee on that? And again, you touched on the RAIN proposal. Are we going to be going into a little more detail on that later in the week?
We certainly can. At this point, it wasn't a planned part of the presentation. Is there something specific you want to know about it?
Well, thank you, Ms. Rademacher. And I will ask if some of the returning committee members will correct me if my memory is faulty. But it seemed to me that 2 years ago when we were at this point and RAIN came in and asked for $2 million, the indication is that would be the last time they would be making that kind of a request.
It wasn't the indication, Mr. Co-Chair. It was the promise.
That's certainly something that we can incorporate into our presentation later on, and it may also be an appropriate phase two topic for the next set of hearings.
We'd certainly be interested in hearing more about that, and thank you for refreshing my memory, Co-Chair. All right, let's talk about rural entrepreneurship.
Great. This really enters into the part of the presentation which includes the agency requested policy option packages. This one, we call it different things. The name has evolved over time. It's currently known as the Rural Opportunities Initiative, or ROI project. It's also referred to as Rural Entrepreneurship or even the READY projects. What this is it's building on a successful pilot program that we initiated this last biennium, in which we created four centers for entrepreneurship in Baker City, LaGrand, Klamath Falls, and Coos Bay. These projects are meant to bring together existing resources and partners to fund the coordination of small business startup services by bringing together the supports and agencies that are already in a community. It leverages local resources and provides a focal point for entrepreneurs to get the information and services that they require. What this asks for is $1 million in new funding to be able to expand the project from the four centers that currently exist now and offer the opportunity to existing communities. We have interest that's been expressed in 25 different rural communities across the state, and one of the reasons that this policy option package is important to us is because it really does provide a direct manifestation of the strategic priorities that we talked about yesterday, which is providing the innovation and entrepreneurship resources as well as reaching the underrepresented communities throughout the state.
I'm Co-Chair.
Could you differentiate for us the distinction between the work that the Rural Entrepreneurship Program would be accomplishing and the small business development and the other business assistance? How are you not going to be stepping on each other's toes or getting, you know, multiple? Would it be possible for two of these programs to service the same client?
Co-Chair Johnson, member of the committees. Three out of the four projects that already exist include the Small Business Development Center as full partners. This really provides a place where we can bring together the resources and programs that already exist. The intent is not to duplicate, but to make sure that the entrepreneurs and startup businesses in the community can find those services and access them. So it's not funding new programs per se, as it is providing a little bit of seed funding in order for those partners to come together. Sometimes they have a place in the community that becomes known as the Center for Entrepreneurship. And I think you're going to hear quite a bit more about this policy option package from our Innovation and Entrepreneurship Manager, Heather Stafford, either later today or tomorrow.
Thank you. I'd just like to delve a little bit deeper in the co-chair's question. You describe a partnership between the Rural Entrepreneurship Program and the SBDCs. And we're talking about $1 million for four communities in this program, and the SBDCs are getting $2 million for 19 communities. So what is the nature of this partnership?
Absolutely, Co-Chair Gomberg, members of the committee. There hasn't been $1 million dedicated to the four centers that exist now. Basically, our pilot project started out by investing $260,000 in strategic reserve funding into this project in order to basically test the concept and see if it worked. The four centers are getting approximately $60,000 apiece. The intent moving forward is that we would use a competitive process to determine not only would these existing centers move into phase two of development of these projects, but also bring in another set of phase one projects in new communities. And we've had interest from basically every corner of the state and been out there meeting with community members to assess their interest. And so I would equate it, and this is my language, so if I'm overstepping, I apologize. I would equate it more to an entrepreneurship one-stop kind of environment. And this is providing a little bit of that resource to be able to connect to the existing programs, market them, and make sure that people are aware that they're available to them and how to access them.
All right. Thank you very much.
Co-Chair Gomberg, please. Co-Chair Johnson, if you don't mind, I'll add to that. I think one of the differences is the models being presented by our pilot communities have been identified by them. So this is how they would like to bring the various small business support resources together, and then we kind of invest in what they have brought forward to us versus we're not investing necessarily in specific organizations.
Any other questions? All right. Let's move forward. Thank you.
Thank you. The agency's second priority for policy option packages is recapitalizing our Special Public Works Fund. This fund is, and this package requests $50 million in lottery bond proceeds to place into a revolving loan fund for public facilities and projects that support economic development goals. It includes things, and it's used for water, wastewater projects, roads, industrial site development, things like that. The intent of this $50 million is to dedicate $40 million of it to municipal projects where they can use it as match for federal grants and also to provide grant or loans to cities and other municipalities. $10 million of it would be dedicated to levy inspection and repair.
A question from Representative Reardon.
The levy project was shared with some of us recently, and it raises a lot of concerns, obviously, about need to protect, like, Portland Airport and all the industrial land and all of that. So is $10 million enough?
No.
I mean, I would question how that, you know, that split came up, so the $40 million versus $10 million, because that's obviously a huge need to protect that area, and I'm extremely concerned about it. So.
Co-chairs, Representative Reardon, the need for these projects always outweighs the demand. This is building on, in our current budget, the SPWF, or Special Public Works Fund, is a revolving loan fund, and we look at projects on an ongoing basis. In the current biennium, we funded $5 million in levy projects and dedicated it. And this is in response to increased demand for those projects and just wanting to make sure that the money is available for that purpose. And I think when you start hearing about our infrastructure programs, they're going to present some information about just exactly what that need is and cite a study that talks about the investment that would be needed, and basically this is our intent to start somewhere.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, if you don't mind, I'd like to provide an illustration that shows you the scope of the problem. The Scappoose Drainage District operates a fairly active drainage district. In the past, they have had levees that, in partnership with the Corps, were recertified to the amount of about $50,000. Now that the federal government is no longer fully participatory in helping with the recertification, it was left to the drainage district to do this on their own. And the price has soared up to 2 $2 million, and this is just for an area in Scappoose. The downside of not taking care of these water management devices is that homes behind them, and you're sitting next to a real estate professional, homes behind them are unable to get flood insurance. And a family could see their largest single asset lose all of its value because they're behind an uncertified dike or levee. And working in partnership with the Corps, these were relatively simple recertifications. But Congress passed an amendment called the Wright Amendment that makes it impossible for the government, the Corps of Engineers, to compete with private engineers. And consequently, a private engineering company has to come out, look at the dike, put their stamp on it. The liability alone accelerates the cost. And the dikes have to be recertified with greater frequency. So that just puts it in context. And it, traditionally, the people that paid in behind a dike were the farmers that had arable farmland as a result of the function of the dike. And so it's prohibitively expensive. And that's just outside of Scappoose. There are diking districts all over the state, even in some arid places where they're managing water flow. So it's a giant problem.
The next policy option package that the agency requested requests $441,000 in other funds for two compliance specialists for the Certification Office for Business Inclusion and Diversity. What this office does is it basically certifies businesses that are minority-owned, women-owned, and service-disabled, veteran-owned, and emerging small businesses so that they can be eligible and more competitive for different procurement opportunities. The way this package is funded is by assessing other state agencies that use the program and building it into the price list of what they pay for. The dominant agency that uses most of these services and thus pays most of the bill is the Oregon Department of Transportation. The reason we need these two positions, there's currently four compliance specialist positions funded in this office, this would take us to six, is that we've had several new legislative mandates placed on the office. One is just the creation of the new Service Disabled Veteran Certification Program. And the second is that House or Senate Bill 584 in a previous session requires us to now investigate any allegations of fraud amongst the people being certified. We have certain businesses, and we hear rumors, especially businesses that are their husband and wife owned kind of businesses, about whether who really owns it and things like that. What our intent is here is to really, instead of waiting until we're getting these allegations of fraud, is to get out in front of the problem and increase our commitment to performing site visits and meeting with these businesses proactively. And so we don't have certification specialists that are dedicated to each of these programs. All six of the certification programs would be acting in all programs, and they would be getting out there and visiting the 3,600 certified firms as well as any new applicants for the program.
Well, thank you, Ms. Rademacher, and you're absolutely right. We did expand this program to include service-disabled veterans. We did ask for greater recognition of fraud questions, but the other thing we did is that we asked that the contracts available be broken into smaller parts so that more companies could apply for them, particularly smaller companies, and I expect that would create an additional demand on this department as well.
Absolutely. Co-Chair Gomberg, members of the committee, there's also talk right now that we're having with the Department of Transportation. They are interested in pursuing a small business enterprise program, and that would also increase the demand for the program and the need to go out and do those site visits.
All right, thank you.
The next policy option package that in our budget is for the seismic rehabilitation program. This would add $202 million of tax-exempt general obligation bonds and upgrade school and emergency service buildings in case of a large seismic event. The project is a continuation of the current work that we're doing in this biennium, and our intent is to go out there and use that competitive process to award approximately 161 new school grants and 20 grants to emergency service buildings. The awards for these projects are up to $1.5 million per project. We anticipate the sale of the bonds to occur in two steps. The first one being selling $120 million in May of 2018, and the next one being selling $80 million in March of 2019.
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
Thank you, sir. Quick question on the retrofit, seismic retrofit for schools. How is that process, I guess, either prioritized, or is it just first in, first out? Because looking at our, you know, resiliency plan, are we looking to retrofit those schools at most danger, in the most danger of collapse first, moving east, or what's the priorities of this allocation of these funds?
Co-Chair Gomberg, Representative Meek, members of the committee, we have an application process as well as a group of people that review those applications, and we look at a number of different criteria. I think you're going to hear a lot more about people who know more about this program later on, and they may be better able to answer that question. What I do know is that the demand far outweighs what our capacity is, again, even for the continuation of this program. We have over 1,500 schools in the state that are gauged to be from moderate to very high risk, and over 250 emergency service buildings. And so what we need to do is look at a number of criteria, everything from the need, but also the ability to fund and complete the projects, and a number of criteria. And I would expect that you'll be hearing more from our Assistant Director for Economic Development Department about that very shortly.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Next is a policy option package for our new solar incentive program. This is a new program that the department received in the short session in 2016 through House Bill 4037. What it does, and I'm talking about the program in general right now, not the POP, is it provides a half-cent incentive per kilowatt for projects producing photovoltaic energy for 5 years. These are fairly large solar projects, ranging anywhere from 2 to 10 megawatts of energy production. This program has a cap of funding 150 megawatts. We recently completed our application process, and we received applications requesting over 280 megawatts of incentives. And so right now, it's fully subscribed and also has an ongoing pipeline if the program continues. When we received this program in the last session, it came to us with the incentive money, but only with a limited duration position. The program, because it's a five-year program, doesn't sunset until 2023. And so in order to continue operating the program, we're asking for $219,000 in general fund to be able to fund the permanent position that is managing these projects and the program. And so it's asking for a permanent position instead of the limited duration position we received. And that really concludes the additions portion of our of the governor's recommended budget. And now we'll be moving into talking about what some of the reduction options are that have been identified. And what you'll see here is that, I mean, as you all know, statutorily we're asked to produce lists of 10% cuts in each biennium. This year, the governor's recommended budget requested a list for 12% reductions, and so that's what I'll be talking about initially. When you're talking about a 12% reduction to Business Oregon, you're really looking at cuts that will affect staff, operations, and programs in almost all of our divisions. Over half of the reduction that you'll see occurs in our strategic reserve fund. That would be about $3.8 million. Our industry competitiveness fund at $275,000. And our Oregon Innovation Council, and that would be at around $800,000. These three programs combined allow us to provide direct assistance and grants to companies. They really make up some of the foundational programs for our business programs. And when you're looking at cuts to those programs, it does have the potential to affect our key performance measures and our ability to create those jobs and to produce the income tax generation. Another area where the 12% reductions touch the operations of the department is that we'd be cutting $250,000 from our Japan representative office. That's an office that we have available for Oregon companies to visit in Japan when they're trying to enter into that market. That effectively is cutting two positions or 1.5 FTE. Another reduction that is the elimination basically of an entire program is the deletion of our facilities program. It's not a big program. It's basically one person. But we do have 7 leased facilities and all of the throughout the state, as well as building maintenance and vehicle management and things like that that get done by that program. The film and video office in this 12% take a cut of approximately $181,000, and that's a 15% reduction to that budget, and it eliminates 8 positions from the department. On the general fund 12% list, as I said yesterday, that we have a really limited amount of general fund that's not dedicated to debt service. In fact, almost all of it, other than the new solar incentive dollars we received lately, is located in our Arts Commission budget. And so a 12% reduction in general funds basically impacts our Arts Commission most directly. It would reduce grants to arts programs by about 30% and potentially reduces the operating funds available to 150 different arts organizations. The second impact of the general fund reductions on this $529,000 reduction is that it reduces our ability to put on the Oregon Arts Summit, which is really the only statewide arts gathering that we have in Oregon. In addition to, when we were preparing to come to this hearing, we had the 12% options. We were also asked to cover what it would look like if we went even deeper at the 15% level. What that basically means is that you would combine the 12% reductions that I already discussed and go deeper in a lot of these areas. You particularly see about an $8 million cut to business programs, along with a reduction of 6 FTE, a $1 million reduction to infrastructure programs with loss of 3 FTE, and $840,000 and 3.5 FTE in operations. And again, the film and video cut remains at the same level of $181,000. Uh, When you get to the general fund, again, there's only two places to go. We would continue to see the same level of cut for the Arts Commission, but also the other pot of money that is available is to reduce the solar incentive money that is available to go out to those projects that have recently applied. And so you'd see about half of the cut coming in the Arts Commission and about half in the solar incentive program. And as I said, we have 150 megawatt cap, but we had applications from every corner of the state equaling 280 megawatts. And lastly,
excuse me, yes, Representative Nierman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So you have a cap of 150 megawatts, or I think there was also a deadline of January of this year, whatever. So and then you're saying you have applications totaling 280 megawatts then. So you're done then, right? So why do you need any more money for that program?
Co-Chair Gomberg, Representative Nierman, we have money in our budget to be able to pay the incentives, and that's general fund money. What the total cost for the program over its five-year lifetime would be is, I believe, $8.2 million. What's in our current budget to be able to pay the incentives for the projects that, and they were chosen based on readiness, and so some projects are up and running and we'll start paying those incentives very shortly. Others are going to start coming online throughout the biennium and later on. And so any particular project is eligible for incentives for 5 years. But we know that up front, the first application process, we received more applications for more incentive money than we were granted. And so basically, where we're going to draw the line is at where the amount of money we have is. And so basically, the ones that are going to get funded, it is going to be a first come, first served in terms of the ones that are producing energy first. And so if you come online later, then that money won't be available to you with the existing budget. This cut is potentially saying we wouldn't have the $8.2 million available or even the $3.4 million in this current biennium, but we would scale that back to 2.9, which means the amount of incentives we'd be able to pay would have to be ratcheted back. Does that make sense? Mm-hmm.
Follow-up?
I'm having a tough time with the math on that, right? So you're not going to fund a total of 150 megawatts then, or you are?
I'm sorry if I was unclear. We'll absolutely fund the full 150 megawatts of projects. There's 130 megawatts that we won't be able to fund, right, because we don't have the incentive money able to pay. And so in the respect of who gets funded, and I'm oversimplifying, it really is a first come, first serve kind of thing in terms of when they're producing that energy.
Okay, thanks.
Good. The last slide that I'm going to cover today is just talking briefly about what our Business Oregon's agency requested bills are, and these are bills that will be heard in other committees. The first one is Senate Bill 12, which is a request for us to be able to do national FBI fingerprint-based criminal record checks. We currently have an executive order that allows us to do statewide LEDS checks, but as I think you've probably already gathered, we hire a lot of financial professionals to run the programs that are in our department. That means that we do national recruitments for these positions. And currently, we don't have the statutory authority to be able to find out if they have a national criminal background check, only the state of Oregon. And so if they're coming from outside of Oregon, it creates a void in the information that we have in order to make our decisions. And so when we consulted with the Oregon State Police, they told us that the FBI will not allow us to do those fingerprint checks unless it's actually written into our statute that we have the authority. And so that's what Senate Bill 12 is about. House Bill 2242 creates a definition of traded sector activities to modernize the Oregon Business Development Loan Fund. Traditionally, our definition of traded sector has focused in on manufacturing type of activities. We just want to create a definition that allows us to fund additional businesses such as software and gaming and some of those that are more on the intellectual property right instead of the stuff that gets in the traded sector definition currently. In House Bill 2243, that increases the number of e-commerce zones and extends the sunset of e-commerce tax credit to 2024. It increases the number of projects or potential projects from a current number of 15 to a potential of 21. And it also includes some clawback provisions and some better reporting requirements to make sure that they're meeting that job development goals that are required. House Bill 2244 extends the sunset of the Green Light Oregon Rebate Program from 2017 until 2023 for qualifying film and video companies. This is film companies that come into Oregon and spend over $1 million, get a partial rebate of the amount of payroll taxes that are withheld. I think it's 6.2%. And lastly, House Bill 2245 is basically a placeholder. We are working with Treasurer Tobias Reed to potentially put together a task force to find some permanent source of funding for our Oregon Growth Fund program. And we expect this bill to evolve, but right now it's an exploratory kind of a bill. And that's all I have for our policy option packages, reduction options, and the agency bills.
Thank you, Ms. Rademacher. Any questions? Okay. Mr. Harder, what's next?
So up next, now that we're going to move from the budget presentation, we have our assistant directors and managers coming up to walk through in more detail many of the programs you heard about that have budget implication. I think a lot of the questions you've had will be addressed going forward now. So if you don't mind, I can bring them up to the table.
Please do.
Okay.
Welcome, gentlemen.
Thank you, Co-Chair Gomberg, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Chris Cummings, and I'm the Assistant Director for Economic Development for Business Oregon. Yesterday, Director Harder mentioned about our reorganization and how we're working to remove silos from the department. We've done this to keep up with the evolving nature of economic development and the projects that we are seeing. For many of our projects now, it's not just simply an infrastructure project or an innovation project or a business project. What we're seeing are projects that need resources from all of our programs. And we hope that bringing these programs together under one division will allow us to build some synergies amongst our staff, amongst the program activities, so that we can address our current needs. Oh, I forgot about this. Give you an idea of where the division is within the department. You can see on the screen that we brought together innovation, entrepreneurship, business services, and infrastructure, as I had mentioned. Many of these people are made up of many of our programs are only as good as our staff that we have working those programs, and we have an excellent staff. Speaking of this staff, what we want to start with in our program discussion today is a program that's awfully often unnoticed. We often speak about our programs and our money sources, but we don't often talk about our people who are out in the field, our outward-facing people. These are our business development officers, formerly known as business development officers, now they're regional development officers, regional program managers, our recruitment staff, and our global trade team. With me today is Robert Ault, our manager of our community and economic development, business and community development unit, and he's going to speak about this outward-facing program.
Thank you, Co-Chair Johnson, committee members. For the record, my name is Robert Alt. I manage the Business and Community Development Division for Business Oregon. Thank you for the opportunity to address you. I'd like to briefly discuss our role in the agency. The organizational chart shows that the division includes business and community development. It includes global trade and business recruitment and retention. In many respects, our division is the face of the agency. Our goal is to offer a comprehensive array of services that are easy to access and much like one-stop shopping. The regions that are reflected on the screen largely mirror those of regional solutions teams. However, we have added an additional regional development officer in the Southeast because of the geographic expanse that it encompasses. Regional development officers will be based in the 12 regions. Having those staff regionally based is really critical to understanding the regional economies. Regional project managers will work in tandem with regional development officers to implement infrastructure and business projects. Regional development officers serve as the point person for agency business and infrastructure projects and serve many roles. They serve as a relationship manager. They also ensure that we're utilizing all agency resources that may be relevant to regional projects. They make sure that all relevant state and federal resources are identified. They identify, develop, and shepherd projects. Regional project managers work closely with the regional development officers to coordinate and implement projects. They provide one-on-one assistance to aid in project development. They assist in identifying the most favorable funding packages. They provide direct assistance to complete necessary applications. They also, importantly, monitor ongoing projects to make sure all funds are being spent in a responsible fashion and that the projects are completed. Business Oregon also has staff that assist with recruitment. We have staff that assist with global trade. We have finance officers that work with both municipal and private borrowers, and program experts that help navigate sometimes complex federal regulations. I spoke of the regional development officers as the initial point person for the agency, which is true. As I also mentioned earlier, the staff of this division represent in many respects the face of the agency. They manage stakeholder relations, both public and private. They identify and evaluate projects, structuring deals, and coordinating a comprehensive programmatic response. They help us develop a pipeline that establishes demand and proactively allows us to respond to the needs of businesses and communities with a view on the needs of the whole state, but a clear focus on regional differences. The final slide shows annual impact for 2016. We worked with over 450 community infrastructure projects. We did outreach to approximately 500 traded sector companies. We worked on over 120 business expansion projects, estimated to create more than 900 jobs. We had 22 successful recruitments, representing an estimated 2,477 jobs. And we provided export promotion services and grants to over 160 small businesses, with exports resulting in $141 million in new sales. The assistance we provide is often comprehensive from project inception to completion, with assistance that varies depending on the capacity of the customer. Thank you for allowing me to address you. At this time, I'll turn it back to my colleague, Chris Cummings.
Thank you.
Co-Chair Gomberg, members of the committee. These staff, as Robert had mentioned, they really do wonders with adding to our capacity to get our programs out and our money out the door, but also capacity for small communities. As you can imagine, many of our small communities, they may have one or two staff members, and oftentimes we're there helping them put a deal together and package that deal and get it through. So you've heard about our field staff. They're out there delivering the projects and programs in many cases. But I'm here today also to speak about our infrastructure programs, and I know that you've had some questions yesterday and today, and I'm happy to address those. But first, I need to apologize a little to you if I sound a little scripted. And the reason I sound scripted is because our manager, who was going to speak about infrastructure today, had a family emergency, so I'm taking over his role. However, I'm perfectly happy going off script and answering any questions that you might have. give you an idea of where the infrastructure programs reside within our department, you can see that they're in the Economic Development Division. They're now aligned with our business services programs. And even though it's grayed out up here on the screen, right next to the middle blue block, we still have the Infrastructure Finance Authority, and they're statutorily responsible for some of our programs, such as you'll hear about special public works and safe drinking water and ports and community development block grants. But they still exist within the department. With our infrastructure programs, we invest in community health and safety and economic and community development and industrial lands programs. I'd like to point out that much of our economic development work around the state revolves around infrastructure work. Infrastructure work is the basis for whether a business can locate into a community or expand in a community. Do they have enough water pressure? Are there fire hydrants? Is the land ready to locate? So those are all some of the foundations that we see in economic development projects. To give you an idea, there was a question earlier about the need of levee systems, and I'll touch on that in a few minutes. But to give you an idea of the need for infrastructure, there was recently a survey done by the League of Oregon Cities and for infrastructure need over the next 20 years. And what we saw, or what they found, was over $7 billion in need for basic water, sewer, water, and storage systems for communities around the state. It's really important to point out that even though this need is high, it's probably much higher because this survey only took into account cities, not our special districts, not our port authorities, not our counties, etc. I think it's also probably common knowledge for anybody who's watching the news that most of our infrastructure, or much of our infrastructure, I should say, was built over 70 years ago in the New Deal era. And what we're seeing now are some municipalities that are looking to upgrade their infrastructure, and we're hoping to maintain that with the fund that Ramona had spoken about earlier with our POP for Special Public Works. And we'll get into that in a second. Today, we're going to primarily cover these five programs: Special Public Works, Water, Wastewater, Safe Drinking Water, Seismic Rehabilitation, and Community Development Block Grants. And I'm happy also to go into any further detail about the other programs, but primarily I have this laid out so that we cover these in more detail. These other programs, Brownfields, Ports, Industrial Lands, Broadband, and Regional Infrastructure Fund, which is the RST fund, are just as important to our communities. However, they're just not to the same scale as some of the other programs that we're going to cover in more detail. And as I mentioned, I'm happy to go over in more detail any of these programs later in the presentation or at a later time. Special Public Works Fund provides market rate loans and grants to municipalities for infrastructure improvements and other facilities that support economic and community development. The fund provides financing for industrial site development, emergency projects, water, wastewater projects, and a whole host of other projects that are owned and operated by municipalities. And for the record, municipalities cover a huge expanse of local districts, the port authorities, as I mentioned, and et cetera. So I just use the word municipality as a catch-all. This is primarily a loan program, where there are forgivable loans for job creation and planning grants available sometimes. Funding for this program is primarily from lottery bonds and loan repayment. And as Ramona had mentioned earlier, we have a policy option package for $40 million for this program, of which we have an additional $10 million in that POP. It's actually a total of $50 million, the POP. $40 million for Special Public Works, $10 million for levy. When there was a question earlier about how did we decide to break it out, we look at the need, and I will get into a little bit more of the need on levees, but the need for general infrastructure is much greater than the need for levee infrastructure, so we broke it out in that sense. Give you an example of a Special Public Works funded project, the City of Lebanon's new wastewater treatment plant we recently funded. The plant was constructed in 1946, and the new treatment plant is capable of servicing city water needs for the next 50 years. So they had one, and now they're building a plant to look out for the next 50 years, which is wonderful. The total for this project, this is one of our largest projects, was $21 million. $10 million came from Special Public Works Fund, and $11 million came from Special Public Works Fund, and another $10 million came from our Safe Drinking Water Fund, which you'll hear about briefly. But that's just a small example, and it's within infrastructure wholly, but how these projects are, what we're seeing are projects that are getting so large that we need to take different pots of money to make them work. So Special Public Works provides levee financing to stabilize the health and safety of levee systems throughout our state, and it's critical for economic reasons. For levee projects, the Special Public Works Fund provides grants, zero-interest loans, and standard rate loans to municipalities, drainage districts, and private drainage companies. Many of our levees are operated or controlled by private companies as well. This is one of the few areas that our infrastructure programs are available to private sector. Projects must be primarily for the purpose of completing certification documents or obtaining accreditation by FEMA. So as Senator Johnson had mentioned earlier, when a levee is not accredited, that area that's protected behind it is often mapped into a high-risk flood zone area. And when it's mapped into that area, it could require flood insurance for homeowners and businesses, and it could also trigger where local communities put additional construction standards on businesses and buildings. So the importance of levees to protect those, to at least keep the prices down, the cost down, not to mention health and safety issues, is huge. But to give you an example of a levee project or a levee issue, would be the $3.3 million Multnomah County Levee Accreditation Project for Levee Ready Columbia. This project helps protect the Portland International Airport, the Port of Portland, three major interstate highways, and two freight railroads, and $16 billion in annual economic activity. Failure to maintain these levels to the Army Corps of Engineers standards puts regions, its residents, and, of course, as I mentioned, the economy at risk of losing federal assistance during and after high water events. And as I mentioned, it may lead to higher costs for flood management in the future. So our policy option package for this is $10 million. And I gave you the one prime example that a lot of people know about, which is the Portland levee. But there are levees across the state. And as Senator Johnson mentioned, there are in some areas that one wouldn't expect. Mostly people don't realize they exist either. They ride by them every day or on top of them in some cases and don't realize they're there protecting their community. Getting to a question that was earlier mentioned, there are approximately 333 levee miles in Oregon, and they're all held with 213 different authorities. So the Army Corps of Engineers determined that 35% of these levee miles are unacceptable, and 43% are minimally acceptable. So you can imagine the size of most of our levee system within the state is not acceptable. Ramona had mentioned earlier, too, this is basically a start. We have to start somewhere, and this is where we're asking to start. The Water Wastewater Fund provides loans and grants to community systems that have received or are about to receive a notice of noncompliance from a regulatory agency. Eligible projects include planning, design, and construction of water, wastewater, and stormwater systems. Disadvantaged or distressed communities may be awarded grants up to $750,000 and interest rates as low as 1%. The source for this is lottery, bonds, and other funding. Here's an example of this funding from this fund project. The City of Drain, $7.8 million wastewater improvement project. City is under a mutual agreement and in order with the EQ, requiring improvements to be made to the current system and to provide adequate wastewater infrastructure for 20-year period. We provided $4.8 million in loans for this, $750,000 in grants, or forgivable loan, I should say, and $2.2 million in community development block grants, which is a federally funded program that I'll mention in a few slides here. That we operate. Again, the project is so big that we had to bring in a few different sources of funding to make sure that it would happen. Give you an idea of how much we've funded with this project over the last year. In 2016, we awarded 22 projects at $10.2 million. Our Safe Drinking Water Program is a federally funded program with a state match. Business Oregon administers the program on behalf of the Oregon Health Authority. So as we mentioned earlier, how we administer the Regional Solution Team projects, we also administer this project for another agency. The program provides financing and other assistance to publicly and privately owned water systems for projects that further public health protection goals of the Safe Drinking Water Act and Oregon's Drinking Water Quality Act. So again, we are able to tap into some privately owned systems here with this funding, but primarily we're looking at publicly owned systems. An example here would be the City of Adair's reservoir replacement and river intake improvements. The city was experiencing a loss of 45%, the loss rate of 45%, which is pretty huge. Much of the loss was from two storage reservoirs, which date back to, of course, the early 1940s. So we funded this program with $2.3 million in loan and a little over $500,000 in forgivable loan. For 2016, we awarded 33 projects for a total of $44.5 million. The Seismic Rehabilitation Program, which Ramona touched on briefly before, was created in 2005 by the 2005 legislature. And the program was originally with the Oregon Emergency Management, but transferred to Business Oregon in 2014. It's a competitive grant program that provides funding for the seismic rehabilitation of critical buildings, particularly public schools and emergency service buildings. And as we discussed earlier, we have a $202 million POP request to recapitalize this fund. Give you an idea, it's right here in front of me, on the need for seismic rehabilitation. In 2007, Dalgami conducted a study of schools and emergency service buildings to see where the need was. And there were approximately 293 schools listed as very high risk of failure in a seismic event, and another 800 at high risk. This study estimated the cost to be to partially retrofit all these schools' buildings at $1.6 billion, a little over that. The study also estimated there were roughly 54 very high-risk and 195 high-risk emergency service buildings with a cost of over $3 billion. For the current biennium, we're projecting that we'll do 124 retrofits totaling $175 million for schools, and also another 20 retrofits for emergency service buildings totaling $30 million. To get to the question of how do we select these projects, are they generally in a more seismic areas or not, is not necessarily. We have a statutorily designated committee that looks at our projects, and basically we start with a benefit-cost analysis, and location and seismic activity for that location is taken into consideration, but it's not the only consideration. Generally speaking, the committee believes that the funds are available to statewide, so they look at statewide projects because they are general fund dollars. So it's not necessarily a priority, but in some cases it is. And that's, I know that's not a yes or no answer, but that is in fact the answer.
Can I ask a question? I'm sorry. Representative Nierman.
So on this, you say that the grants are limited to $1.5 million per project. Is that spreading yourself too thin? What do you get for $1.5 million to retrofit a school?
Sure. There has been a lot of discussion, and there is something that right now, actually, the grants are limited to $1.5 million, and I believe that's what we had mentioned in our last legislative session that we wanted to loan at. Our committee would like to look at that number to see if it should go up or not a little bit. But when we talk about retrofits, say, for a school, it's not always the whole school. It's a part of the school that can be separated so that that part doesn't fall down. So, for instance, if you're in Eastern Oregon, let's say you're in Burns, you may want to take your gymnasium to be the part that's retrofitted because that's where most people will be located at any given part of the day, and they can retrofit that with $1.5 million, depending on the size of the school, or they have some match. We only go up to that amount. But when we award grants, they have to have the total funding available to complete the retrofit.
Thank you.
Can Community Development Block Grants, or CDBG as we call them, uses federal funds from HUD to provide rural, non-metropolitan cities and counties with grants to develop economic opportunities and create suitable living environments for lower-income households. A project that some of you may have heard of or be aware of is the City of Vernonia's $2.4 million Senior Center Food Bank, which utilized $2 million in community development block grants to rebuild. For CDBG, a match is not required from the local entity. However, they are required to have the total project cost in hand, just as I mentioned with the seismic rehabilitation, to get a project approved.
Co-chair.
Mr. Cummings, you gratuitously reached out to Vernonia, which is now going to elicit a question from me. Also in Vernonia was another long-ago CDBG project. It was before you took this job, but my recollection of that community center's design and planning and being built gave rise to my understanding about how complicated CDBG is. And I don't know whether or not the federal government, with the change of administrations, is going to continue to fund CDBG. I don't know if local economic development drivers understand all the rules around CDBG. And to the degree, now that this is in your portfolio, that you could provide the committee with some reassurance that you're doing outreach so that people understand. It was my experience that community enthusiasm got built up before all of the numbers were in place and before we really knew where we were going. And I would just like some reassurance that you're helping local folks, well-meaning and enthusiastic local folks, understand that CDBG is not always a program for neophytes.
Senator, Co-Chair Johnson, members of the committee, correct. CDBG is quite a complex program. But to assist with that, as part of our restructure, we've moved one of our regional, what were known as regional coordinators, into a regional program manager, just titles there, with just CDBG projects. So that coordinator will be working on just CDBG projects along with our other two staff that work on CDBG. And the hope is that over time we build a consistent message that every community knows. They hear the same thing. They hear about the difficulties with working with CDBG grants and the reporting requirements that come along with it, and be able to help them and add some capacity.
That's great. And just colleagues, I have the highest confidence in Mr. Cummings. I worked very closely with him when he had another life in state government. And this is a guy who has threaded the needle of public participation in some really complicated projects and, in my view, is a rock star. So if anybody's going to sort out the complexities of CDBG, it's that guy right there.
Co-Chair Johnson, thank you. No pressure on that. Give you an idea of last year's awards. We awarded $15 million to 13 projects. Some of them we award projects for community facilities and housing rehabilitation and water wastewater projects, sometimes for match for those bigger projects. Generally speaking, this CDBG fund for years has been declining. It's no secret it declines for the last 10 years plus. So what we receive each year is roughly a little over $11 million. So I mentioned that I won't be doing a deep dive on these projects, but of course, if any of them pique your interest, I'm happy to stop and discuss them more. But the Brownfields program is a program that our department operates, and what it does is it provides state and federal financing through loans and grants to help assess and clean up contaminated properties. In 2016, we had 21 projects that were primarily funded through grants. The Brownfields program, which ties a little bit into the lands program, and was within a unit that we had, lands, before this reorganization, is also available to private sector. So we do help public and private sector entities with cleanup of contaminated properties. The Industrial Lands Program prioritizes and certifies Oregon's high-value industrial land sites for development. In fiscal year 2015-2016, we were able to certify or pre-certify five shovel-ready sites. There was a question yesterday about how we, and I'm sorry, I I don't recall who asked the question, but how we certify these sites, whether we're paying for people to complete the infrastructure necessary to certify the sites. And we are, in some instances. We have some small grants that are available to do some initial studies for certification. And when I say in some cases we're paying for people, we also have, if it's a public sector owned property, we have our Special Public Works Fund and our Brownfields program available to assist those owners with getting those sites ready for certification. There was also a question on whether we prioritize public sector sites versus private sector sites, and we don't. And the question, I believe, revolved around the fact that perhaps those public sector sites are being subsidized at a rate where the private sector can't keep up. That's not part of our policy. We have it as far as people coming in for certification, and our goal is to certify as many industrial sites as possible throughout the state. Co-Chair Gomberg and Senator Hansel, I hope that answers. I think you had asked that question. We also have a ports program that provides planning and marketing grants, as well as construction loans for facilities and infrastructures at ports throughout the state. The other thing the ports program works on is assisting with federal and local dredging issues that may occur at local ports, as well as the Columbia River and marine highways. A broadband program. We have a broadband and telecommunications program. In 2009, the legislature created the Oregon Broadband Advisory Council and the Broadband Advisory Council Fund to help ensure that the implementation of statewide broadband strategies go forward. There is no money in this fund right now. Our strength is in our person, Chris Tamarin, who consults with local communities for broadband advice and how we might look at construction for those build out across the state. And recently we've been talking about using some of our other funds, like Special Public Works Fund, to see if there's ability to assist communities with building out broadband.
Question.
Thank you. So 5G is the next thing that's coming. Are you involved with in any way with the preparing communities and preparing, maybe guiding the legislature on what needs to be done to prepare for 5G when it rolls out? Or
Co-Chair Gomberg, Representative Reardon, I can't answer that specifically. I do know that the committee. Council released a report recently that we can get to you, and I suspect that has that in it. But I would have to defer to that report and or our expert, Chris Tamarin, and I can get you the information.
I appreciate that. Thank you.
Surely. And last, but of course not least, is we administer the Regional Infrastructure Fund. The Regional Infrastructure Fund is the fund that the Regional Solution Team monies go into. And basically what we do with that right now is we're managing those projects and ensuring that they go through successfully. Regarding the Regional Solution Program and projects, it's my understanding, and I think it was mentioned yesterday that and today, that you'll hear from them in Phase 2. Since it is their program, we'll let them bring that forth. So that concludes the part of the presentation related to infrastructure programs.
All right. Well, thank you for that. Thank you for standing in. I hope and trust your colleague will be back with us with their difficult situation resolved quickly. I'm looking here, and it looks like the next section is about 15 pages, and we've got about 13, 14 minutes. Why don't we wade into that, because I think we're running a little bit behind our overall schedule.
Great. And I hate to do this to you, Co-Chair Gomberg, but you'll hear from me again on this section. So we'll just carry forward. If I may, give you an idea of where our business incentive programs are. They're in the same area with the infrastructure programs. Again, it's to build that synergy amongst our programs and have one place that staff can go to for understanding these. We also have our business finance programs that are within a different division. And after my presentation, which will likely be tomorrow, you'll hear from our manager for that section. So we have business and development incentives, We're going to walk through some of these tools and that we and our local partners use to attract and help grow businesses in Oregon. These tools serve specific purposes and each have a unique requirement and impact. None of them alone is a silver bullet to getting a business to locate here or grow. It's really a combination of all these programs in many cases that attracts a business or has helps them decide to stay in Oregon. That as well as our infrastructure programs. The first two programs here are local tax abatement programs, and Business Oregon has very little to do with them except to oversight of the programs to make sure that they're in line with statutory and rule requirements. But we'll touch base on these now. Enterprise zones. They help businesses expand in Oregon by exempting local property taxes on new buildings and new equipment. And firms must satisfy, when they enter into this program, they must satisfy requirements for employment and compensation. Local governments administer these enterprise zones. Generally, there's a tax abatement on new construction and the equipment for 3 to 5 years. In some cases, in rural areas, it's up to 15 years. As I mentioned earlier, our role in this is to simply monitor that the zones are within compliance of the statute. But it goes back to something similar to broadband, is we have an excellent staff person in Art Fish who really helps these communities build their zones and understand the rules and regulations that exist. Some things are a little bit complicated. And Art has been doing this for quite a long time and can offer that assistance. 78% of our 69 enterprise zones are located in rural areas, and businesses using the program in 2015 and 16 reported 21,000 employees inside enterprise zones, of which 7,500 jobs were new. Strategic investment program is similar in enterprise zones in that we don't control it. We help monitor it and give expertise to local entities. It's locally driven, and it exempts very large projects from a portion of their property taxes. Companies pay tax on their first $100 million in investment or valuation of property, and in urban areas, the first $25 million of investment valuation in rural areas. So that can give you an idea of the size of the structures and the companies that are usually working within this program and take advantage of it. Current users are generally tech companies and, of course, wind farms with large investments. I'd also like to mention, in addition to that valuation that they're paying on the first $100 million or $25 million of taxable property, they are also assessed a community fee or a pilot, a payment in lieu of taxes, that's negotiated locally. The Oregon Investment Advantage Program exempts some corporate income taxes for new operations that locate in distressed areas of the state. Facilities must be the first of its kind for the company in Oregon. So in other words, this isn't their second type of that same business, and not compete with local businesses. Additionally, the companies must create at least 5 full-time new jobs that are higher than the per capita rate of the county. 12 companies are currently in this program, and they're all in, such as Calbee and Murphy Company, they're all in rural areas of the state.
Mr. Chair?
Please.
Of the 12 companies that are currently using this, could you give a sort of composite profile of what they look like? What industry segments, the number of employees? I'm just trying to get a snapshot of what kind of folks are availing themselves of this opportunity.
Co-chairs Johnson and Gomberg, members of the committee, I would love to give you that information. I don't have it available now. I can do one of two things. I can get it to you after this meeting, or I can phone a friend who's in the room.
I would leave that to discretion of the chair. However, lifelines are always helpful.
As long as we don't poll the audience, I think that we'd prefer just to get the information from you a little bit later and move on.
Of course. Strategic Reserve Fund is a flexible tool of job-creating projects, industry research, and capacity building. These funds are awarded as forgivable loans, not grants, with forgiveness based on job creation and retention standards that normally occur within a two-year period. This fund provides the state with a tool to quickly respond to economic opportunities to provide the state with high-wage jobs. It's a nimble tool for us. Here's a breakdown of the Strategic Reserve Fund for the current biennium. Based on the award so far, the program has contributed to approximately 1,400 jobs created or retained. Additionally, we currently have approximately $5 million in projects in our pipeline at various stages of development. We can use this for companies that come in, and it's a tool, one of the tools that we have that we can say, here's an incentive based on the jobs that you'll create. The return on investment on this program is interesting in that we've estimated that the return on investment is 241% of the amount of dollars we put into it. And that's based on the income tax returns from the new and retained jobs. Give you an idea of some strategic reserve funds. This is a Gentura Road EP Minerals project, and I'm sure you can guess which picture that is. It's that handsome road up there on the left. And what it was
is that the before or the after picture?
That was a before picture.
Okay. He showed you one of the good pictures. There are holes in that road deep enough to bury a Volkswagen bug in.
A diatomaceous earth company operates out in Harney and Malheur counties, and this road needed to be rebuilt so that they would stay operating in the county. We partnered with the two counties because the road actually runs through two counties to pool together funds to solve this problem. What we did, we were able to award $415,000 in strategic reserve fund as well as special public works fund because the counties applied for money, and that's available to public entities, the special public works fund. So we were able to bring those two sort of pots of money, if you will, together to retain 40-plus jobs and create at least another 20 jobs in the community. On the right side, you see Swanson Mill. That mill that was destroyed by a fire in 2014, and there was concern amongst the community that the mill would disperse its work to other mills that they have within the state. Fortunately, we were able to put together a strategic reserve fund award of $400,000 that was part of the puzzle that encouraged the company to stay here, build a new, more modern facility that was 30% larger than the first facility that burned down. Business expansion program is a forgivable loan for expanding companies, adding at least 50 new jobs at 150% of the local wage rate. Requirements for forgiveness are that they create and maintain a specified number of jobs for a minimum of 2 years, and a requirement that the new jobs must generate a level of income tax in 2 years that is greater than or equal to the loan. And we estimate that forward and decide what the loan could be. An example of this would be Simple Finance Technology Corp. in Portland, and they were the sole award in 2016. What they do is they develop technologies for online banking, for mortgages, et cetera, that help give more efficiency to that process. What they were able to do is we awarded approximately $750,000 forgivable loan. They were created 230 new jobs, 74 of which were those high wage earning jobs, over 150% of the average, and they expanded in Portland. Almost $10 million expansion in Portland. The Industrial Competitiveness Fund offers technical capacity assistance to companies and industry to improve their competitiveness in the global marketplace. This assistance may come through export grant assistance or assistance in capacity building programs, such as the Oregon Manufacturing Extension Partnership. We are able to fund the OMEP, as we call them, with monies from this pool of fund, whereas they go out and assist communities, or businesses, I should say, with lean manufacturing principles. And this, in turn, ideally leads those communities to be more efficient and more competitive in the global marketplace. This fund also provides match for our STEP grants, which are assistance for excuse me, which are assisting for state export promotional activities. Ramona touched base briefly on the solar incentive program or solar development incentive program. The solar incentive program was first authorized, as was mentioned earlier, in 2016, and we're in our first round. Basically, the program offers a payment, a direct payment per kilowatt hour generated by qualified solar systems. Half a cent per kilowatt hour generated. For our first round, as I believe Ramona mentioned, we have 53 applications for 280 megawatts, and we only have 150 megawatts available. So of those 53 applications, we expect to see approximately 25 awardees.
Madam Co-Chair.
Will there be companies in the awardee pool that are getting multiple bites at the apple? For example, the Acme Solar Company, and they've got six projects. Would it be conceivable that they would all get funded and somebody else get skunked? Or are you going to try to spread it around? I'm thinking about some of our other energy programs where we've gotten schnookered a little bit, and I presume that your back room is going to be scrutinizing these pretty hard so that we don't get taken like we have in the Department of Energy and some of the loans they made. But tell us a little bit about the mechanics of the project.
Co-Chair Johnson, Co-Chair Gomberg, members of the committee. There are, and we can get a breakdown of that for you, but there are multiple companies that have multiple projects in. So our committee, we have a committee, an internal committee with some external assistants that are looking at those, but I don't have the numbers handy on what that breakdown is. There, as I mentioned, about companies that have more than one project.
Speaking just for myself, I would hope that other meritorious programs that were equally meritorious would have an opportunity to participate before one company got multiple bites at the apple.
I would concur with that. That makes sense.
Well, we'll certainly check into that, and we'll get some information back to you after the meeting. So we have export assistance grants in addition to the Industrial Competitiveness Fund that I previously mentioned. We assist with connecting small businesses to global markets with these grants. Essentially, we assist with the cost for our smaller businesses to attend international trade shows and trade missions. For this biennium, we have over $750,000, of which we awarded 159 companies grants for under $5,000 each. And I would give you an example. However, I'll move on to the next program to meet our timeline here. The final program that I'll mention today is our Certification Office for Business Inclusion and Diversity, which Ramona mentioned earlier, which is COBID. What this program does is offers a variety of certifications to assist minority women and service-disabled veteran-owned businesses, as well as emerging small businesses, with leveling the playing field with inclusion in the marketplace. Primarily, this is a benefit to these companies in the public sector contracting arena, where certain goals and requirements are necessary. Benefits gained by these businesses, again, are the realization of public sector contracts. For my last slide, last year we saw a tremendous jump in our efforts with this program, in that we've increased our event outreach by over 100%. And we've also, because of this, or we like to think it's because of this, that we've also increased our applications received for the year at over 40%. There are no further questions with any of these programs. That would conclude this section.
Any further questions? Co-Chair.
One that can be answered next time, and that is, in comparison with our sister states that are also doing active recruitment, how does our portfolio of recruitment incentives stack up? I hear frequently about the state of New York that is offering the sun, the moon, and the stars, so I presume we're going to finish well behind them. But for our West Coast sister states, how are we doing?
Co-Chair Johnson, I will certainly find out that information and get back to you.
Cool. Thank you.
Other questions?
Well, in that case, I'm going to give you 22 and a half hours to catch your breath.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for moving through this efficiently. We will return to this program tomorrow. I'm going to close the public hearing. Mr. Bender, have you got anything for us before we adjourn?
I do not.
All right. Well, then thank you, everybody. And we are adjourned. All right.